You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 311, which is a band that I don't really know anything about, so I can't make a joke. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Hello and welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. I'm recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on tonight's packed show is an overfull house, more people than we usually have. It's going to be crazy. We have, out of Philadelphia, Mr. John Gentile.
I'm back. I saw 311 once. I'm not a 311 fan, but I saw 311 once at one of these cheesy summer festivals. They rocked the crowd. The crowd was impressed, and I had a good time myself.
It is genuinely a band that I think, as the years go on from when they were popular, I remember less about what made them a thing. I don't remember any of their songs. I kind of remember that people that liked ska maybe liked them.
No, that's like a joke. Like ska people now say they like 311 then. 311 was actually like the first rap hip-hop band, maybe.
Yeah. After
Rage Against the Machine, you know?
Beats me.
Rock hip-hop band.
This show is not about 311. Also joining me, out of Los Angeles, Mr. Ricky Frankel. Ricky, hi.
Hey, guys. Ready for my future grilling for this episode? Just mentally preparing for that.
Ricky knows what's coming.
Oh, yes, I do.
Also joining us again, recent guest host out of, I forget where, USA. help me out.
The dumps of Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, you're from Brooklyn. Mr. Christopher Barrett.
Yo. How are we today?
And that's it. I'm good. So there's four of us on tonight's show. We have lots of stories, and we have some controversy. And John has warned us that he's going to lecture us, and it's going to be pretty good. So John, I guess we'll do some mail before we get into all the craziness. You got anything in particular that you want to read?
Yeah, we got some a short mail here and there. The first mail that I had is now – oh, here it is. Okay. This is actually – Adam White, you and I will both be pleased of this. This is from Bren. Here's what Bren had to say. I saw Screaming Females with Camp Cope on Saturday night in Australia. He didn't write in Australia. Like, I wouldn't write, I saw Screaming Females in the United States. But I'm letting the listeners know he saw them in Australia. He said, largely due to your conversations on the last show and shows previous – I went to see them. They were great. Thank you very much, from Brendan.
Yay. I feel like we made that band $10.
Yeah, we probably made about $12, so we should write them a bill for $1.20, our agent fee, and we'll each get 60 cents. But that's cool, man. You know, Screaming Females, rock. I was actually listening to Rose Mountain today. Adam White, Rose Mountain. We said it before. Let's say it again. Is Rose Mountain a jam or is it a jam?
John, Rose Mountain is a jam.
And this is from Joe the Kid. The listeners might remember Joe the Kid. Joe the Kid, I think he's 12. Do you remember how old Joe the Kid is?
Oh, yeah. I remember him.
Is he 12 or 8?
He's definitely under 14. I think he's like in his preteens, from what I remember.
So we got an email from Joe the Kid. Here's what Joe said. Hey, guys, it's Joe. I'm sorry I have not been writing in lately. I've been busy with my band, and you guys deserve the break from an annoying 12-year-old who loves Minor Threat, Black Flag, Bad Brains, and more recently, Pups and Pears. Nice. Pup and Pears. Nice. Just naming some bands I love. My band has been busy, and I've done demos for our EP. A studio day hasn't been planned, but you can expect the EP out around December. In other news, my brother's band, Zigadoo Money Clips, will be going on tour very soon. I can't give you guys a date until they are officially announced, but I will send you links then. They are kind of an indie ska pop band. Also, I would like to write an article for Punk News about being a 12-year-old and being in hardcore punk. I know something regarding writing articles was on an episode, and I was interested in that. Thanks, Joe. P.S. Punk News Podcast is the best. Oh, I probably should have emailed Joe. This letter's actually from like a month ago. Well, anyway, Joe, definitely, man. I'll send you an email, but we definitely want to hear what you have to say about being a 12-year-old punk rocker. As always, people can always send us ideas. You can send me an idea directly at johng@punknews.org. You can also reach the podcast at podcast@punknews.org. We got another letter from Richard out there in the UK. If you remember on the Sky episode, which was last week, I was saying, you know, was racism really that prevalent in the two-tone ska scene? I don't believe it. Well, Richard from the UK wrote in to put me in my place. Here's what Richard from the UK had to say, if my computer will work correctly. Just listening to the ska podcast. I'll write a longer email later, but trust me, there were loads of issues with race in 1979. So there you have it from Richard in the UK, who was there. Also, Adam White, I got a thorough thrashing about the topic that we're going to cover later. Do you want me to save that till then, or should I mention that now?
I don't even know where you're going with this.
The topic where you referred to me as the Donald Trump of something.
Woo-hoo! Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think you should do this because in preparation for this, because I'm almost as tired of the topic as I'm sure our listeners are, I've decided that I was going to get drunk. So I've been drinking in anticipation of this part. So you can't lose my buzz here.
Could I say I've enjoyed the fact that you're swirling the glass close to the mic.
I should have had a little something for my punishment later.
I don't know how Adam White is saying he's tired of hip hop. So anyways, as you guys all know,
John, I'm tired of you.
Tired of me.
That's totally different. Continue, though.
Adam White, I'm your biggest supporter, Adam White. How dare you be tired of me?
This took a different turn.
No. Okay, I want to hear where this is going. I want to hear where this section is going.
Well, first of all, I'm going to read aloud my trashing from Miguel. Here's what Miguel – on the podcast, I said people that don't know much about hip-hop should listen to Edutainment by Boogie Down Productions. And here's what Miguel had to say. He said here we go. Your hip-hop recommendation list was half-assed. Edutainment before, by all means necessary. Who does that? The worst part is that you recommend Takes and Nations to hold us back, but then say the new recording by Prophets of Rage are iffy. It's the same song. You don't recommend a record like that to a newbie. That's like recommending Mondo Bizarro before Ramones. So that's Miguel taking issue with my hip-hop choices. But as you know, a debate going back and forth about 3 weeks now, which for some reason Adam White's tired of, I don't even know why, is he's tired of me not understanding why Ricky doesn't like hip-hop. So first of all, Chris Barrett. Yeah. Yes. You are a fan of hip-hop, correct?
There's a caveat. So I am a fan of hip-hop before, like, 1995, 1996. So I don't actively listen to hip-hop today, really. This is my thing, too, you know?
How is hip-hop the highest-selling music by form, but I'm the only person that knows anything about it? I saw it on the Pitchfork. It's strictly hip-hop. And I'm the only guy that knows anything about it. Anyways,
I think it's just accessible. You know, people like to dance. People like to go out and have a good time. And it's easier to remix and dance to and casually enjoy hip hop than it is to enjoy a multitude of other musics. Not that other people don't, but it just seems like, I mean, if you're going somewhere to go dance, John Dittilly goes out to the club. Is he going to hear Blitzkrieg Bop, or is he going to hear Hotline Bling?
I'm going to go to a goth new wave club. That's what I'm going to do. I can hear Susie Sue and the Banshees, The Cure.
Run of the mill, you're driving from Philadelphia, and you hit Atlantic City. And you walk into some random joint, you know, playing music with beats. What are you more likely to hear?
Well, hip-hop.
Oh, there you go.
Shocking.
fair enough, Chris. Rest of his case. Adam White, you called me the Donald Trump of the Punk News podcast. However, you are the one that's being frustratingly ambiguous. Do you or do you not like hip hop, Adam? Like, what's your stance?
John, I'm mostly just trolling you because it seems like you've taken a particular interest in this topic, and I honestly have, and I
will explain why. Well, go ahead.
And there's part of me that feels like I want to stand up for my boy Ricky here by being intransigent about it. I actually have a fairly interesting read on the burning news topic of Adam White and hip hop, because I know how much the nation talks about that these days, but I have a theory about it, and it's actually, I think in my mind, like a fairly sober read on it. So it's maybe not as fun as I've been trying to project myself up until right now in this episode. So John, if you'll indulge me, I'll explain to you where I sit on hip hop.
By all means.
So, My whole relationship with music in general all comes from being like a alienated, you know, angry, you know, punk rock kid in the 90s. So when I first got into punk, one of the things that got me into punk in the first place was this notion that it was running counter to what, you know, all the other people that I knew were into. It was running counter to what the popular kids were listening to and in school. It was running counter to what all the cliques were into one way or another when I was in high school. Like, we didn't have like a punk scene per se in like the high school that I was in. There was a few of us that were into it, but really that was it. We had no visible group. So our people, and even the people that sat around in the hallway and professed as being people that liked punk or ska or anything like that, we were just like the leftover people. We were all like the misfits and weirdos that in the school. It wasn't even like we had like a little punk scene we'd go hang around in, at least none that we knew about. So my whole relationship to just music in general was just being anti whatever everyone else was into. So what everyone else was into at the time was, you know, there was a lot of people that were into, I want to say, like, sort of like mainstream ballady rock music. There was a lot of people that were in the high school that I was in that were listening to, say, oh God, I don't know, like Tom Petty and stuff like that, right? And as being anti them and alienating myself from everything that they liked, for a long time, I'm just like, fuck Tom Petty. I don't like that guy. And there were so many bands and so many artists and everything that I was just like, I'm going to be over here with the angry music, and you people that I don't like and don't feel accepted by, you know, are going to go listen to your music, and the twain shall not meet. And hip hop fell on that other side of the divide for me because it was dance music, and these people that were, you know, enjoying their youth and not being angry about everything were, you know, they were having fun and they were dancing. So of course you'd have the dance music that was involved. And I didn't make any sort of distinction between like dumb popular dance music of the 90s and hip hop. It was all just sort of the same ball of whatever I was going to be against to me. So I, of course, as I like stopped being an alienated weird youth, stopped having that opinion about most everything, but that put my general education into what hip-hop was out there and what I should be listening to and what was good, like, it put it way behind the rest of the world to the point where it's not something that I actually think much about these days. So I actually said this to you on Facebook as we were talking about this episode before we got started. To me, my relationship to hip hop at this point is so much like my relationship to most other forms of music that I have total respect for, but no literacy in. So, you know, something like, I don't know, fucking klezmer music or jazz or whatever, right? I look at all these things and I'm like, these are legit forms of music, and there are whole crowds of people that like them, and I get that. I don't know anything about them to the degree that I can make, that I feel like I'm making an informed choice if I'm going and getting into any of this or that. And then when I do go try to get into this or that, it always strikes me as like, ugh, I'm like, I don't actually want to, this is not something that I want to listen to. And it ends up turning me away. So I say that meaning like I have a very difficult relationship with it at this point, because I, by all means, sort of like, I would like to like hip hop a lot. But every time I kind of go into the world, it's always probably not, it's not on the right wavelength, or it's not with the amount of like cultural references I need to be properly walking into it, and therefore it just kind of tires me out, and then I don't do it. I mean, I was on the jury for that Polaris Music Prize this year, and I was listening to the nominated hip hop records, or the suggested hip hop records that were there. And this is all Canadian stuff that people listen. It was all the popular stuff that came out in the past year, stuff like the new Drake album, that album from The Weeknd.
That's all hipster hip hop.
Yeah, but I was listening to it all, and I'm like, I don't like this. I don't like any of this.
Because it sucks,
right? And I'm like, this sucks, right? So. But like, there's a part of me that's like, I'm not approaching it as saying this sucks in the way that I approached it in the 90s. In the 90s, it was sort of like, this sucks because this is what, you know, all the jocks and the cliques and all that shit are into, and fuck you guys, right? That was the you know, 90s high school Adam opinion on this. At this point, I listen to it and I'm like, I'm not enjoying this. So I'm not going to go far as being like, this sucks, because I clearly don't know what I'm talking about, but it's just not for me. So I'm going to go over here and listen to bands on Dirt Nap Records or something like that, right? So that's where I kind of sit on it. So by no means is it something that I am consciously trying to avoid or that I have any aversion to, but I've sort of like, I've retarded my cultural touch points for it. So like, I couldn't listen to any given hip hop record at this point and tell you that like, oh, this is following in the tradition of, you know, of this band and this band and this major band and this that brought you to here, which is what I can do with a lot of punk music and makes me feel a lot more comfortable over there. So that's where I'm going. Sorry, that was long and
Adam
boring,
White,
but that's honestly where I live in my brain.
Adam White, you and I are yin and yang, because people are going to think that we pre-scripted this. You have literally talked to the exact point where I am going. Literally.
Ooh. See?
And so right before I address Adam White's point directly, I'm going to ask Ricky. Ricky, you don't like hip hop, correct?
No.
You can say yes.
I'm not a fan. No. I mean, not like avidly hating it. I just I don't want to go. I don't know where you're going exactly, but you know, I mean, I kind of follow Adam's trajectory kind of you know, fairly similarly. I just, at this point, I just don't care. It's just, when I listen to hip hop, except for maybe like one or two exceptions, it's a chore. It just feels like a chore, and it's not like and so I just would be rather listening to something else. That's all.
Okay, now Ricky, I'm going to speak in coded language to you, and you'll know what I'm talking about if you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, you won't know, because I think we might be on a similar vibe. Is there one certain issue within hip hop that you don't listen to hip hop because of that?
No.
Okay, I don't think you know what I'm referring to. Okay,
I don't.
I'm pretty sure I do. I don't think. I think I know what you're getting at, and I'm going to say no.
Okay, fair enough. So that's good then. Okay. So then, Adam White and Ricky, if I give you, Adam White says he doesn't know where to start with hip hop. Adam White and Ricky. Oh, and actually, Ricky, let me mention this. Is, I used to not like certain genres. I actually used to not like hip hop, but I started to like hip hop when I was about 14. I used to not, what else did I not used to like? I like pretty much everything. The only thing, I mean, the more music you listen to, the more you realize, I used to not like dancehall, now I love dancehall. The more music you listen to, the more you realize there's no such thing as a genre that's not enjoyable. There are, every genre there is so gigantic that within every genre there is wonderful music. You just have to learn how to understand the music through your own brain. When I first heard Slayer, I didn't like Slayer because my brain wasn't hearing it right. But once my brain was able to process it and understand what the band was doing, I love Slayer. Same for the Melvins.
I can get on board with that. I can totally respect that.
Okay, perfect.
Because you know what? I just, honestly, it just, maybe it may be true. I may not have found something I really like, hip hop wise, but I don't know. I just, I guess I just, again, to me, when I listen to, like, if I have to sit through a fucking Kanye song, I just think I'm going to go insane.
See, but that's your problem. You've got the wrong entry point. And Kanye, I'm on the fence on Kanye. I think some of the stuff he does is neat. I think some of the stuff he does is pretentious horse shit. But the reason Kanye is the wrong entry point for hip hop is because Kanye builds off, as is almost all hip hop, all the legendary hip hoppers before him. So Adam White and Ricky Frankel, if I give you 5 hip hop classics, can you listen to them in the next 2 weeks with an open mind? 5 records, that's only 5 hours in 2 weeks.
I can do that. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think I can do that. If you got them streaming?
Yes. You can listen to them on YouTube or wherever. Although I'm kind of sad that you won't hear them on CD, because there's nothing like hearing banging hip hop when you're driving down the street on CD in your car. It's so much better that way, but we'll take what we can get. Here are your five entry points to hip hop records. Number one. Return of the Boom Bap by KRS-One. This is an important record because this is when hip-hop was shifting from old school to new school, and KRS-One, people kind of considered him down and out because he had had a great run with Boogie Down Productions, and they're like, well, what is there left for him to do? So instead of going new school, KRS-One doubled down and kind of did a classic reformation of old school hip-hop, but in a modern context, that makes sense. So you want to listen to KRS-One's Return of the Boom Bap album. Second record you'd want to listen to, Beastie Boys' Paul's Boutique. Beastie Boys' Paul's Boutique is a very, very, very important record in hip-hop. Maybe the most important record. Well, maybe the most important record in hip-hop. You know, Sugar Hill Gang, a couple other records. This is an important record because after the Beastie Boys' first album, everyone expected the Beastie Boys to do License to Ill Part 2 and fall flat on their face. Instead, they, along with the Dust Brothers, reinvented the way hip-hop instrumentals were built, doing sample after sample after sample, and also basically addressing topics in a way and subjects that had not been addressed in hip-hop before to make a thoroughly unique, wonderful, great-sounding record. Beastie Boys, Paul's Boutique. You want to listen to Ice Cube's America's Most Wanted, 1990. This is a very important record because up until 1990, there had been East Coast and West Coast. And actually, there wasn't a feud then between East Coast and West Coast. However, sonically, there was a clear division between East Coast and West Coast hip-hop. Ice Cube had just left NWA because he felt they were stealing his money, and quite frankly, they were. So what Ice Cube did is he went to the East Coast and recorded with the producers of Public Enemy, the Bomb Squad. So it's basically a Public Enemy record with Ice Cube rapping instead of Chuck D and Flavor Flav. The result is a record of Ice Cube showing that he is the most important part of NWA, which he is. You could argue that Dr. Dre is, but I say it's Ice Cube. But also, him addressing social issues through a gangster perspective, which it's come off as a gangster record, but it's really not. It's actually a social record. So you really want to listen to that record. And also, it's probably the first East Coast, West Coast join-up record. The next record you want to listen to, Digital Underground's Sex Packets. Sex Packets is a phenomenal album. A lot of people think it's a novelty record. It is not a novelty record. In fact, it's one of the few hip-hop records of the late 80s, early 90s, that really stays true to the vision of George Clinton. What is it? It's a banging hip-hop record, but it also takes the general idea of, you know, I guess hippiness of Parliament Funkadelic and puts it in a hip-hop context. Also, you'll find the amazing creativity of Shock G, the main Digital Underground guy, going outside of hip-hop, playing a piano, singing soul. He's merging these genres together in a way that doesn't make him seem like a weenie, kind of like Drake does, but really as a guy that is, you know, a man, but that can also sing soul music and piano music and that kind of thing. The last record you want to check out, and you should probably listen to them in the order that I described them to you in. The last one is probably the greatest straight-up gangsta album of all time. Chris Rock says it's the greatest album of all time. I think it's one of the greatest albums of all time. You will listen to Scarface's Mr. Scarface is Back. And this record is very, very important because it's probably the first record that is strictly gangsta rap. There is a social bent to it, but as opposed to Ice Cube, Scarface is interested in showing him strictly as a gangster, telling stories that are true about how he grew up in Houston and what it's like in Houston. It's also one of the most important Southern hip-hop records. It's one of the first Southern hip-hop records that became popular. So I want you guys to listen to those five records. KRS-One's Return of the Boom Bap, Beastie Boys' Paul's Boutique, Ice Cube's America's Most Wanted, Digital Underground Sex Packets, and Scarface's Mr. Scarface's Back. And come back to me in 2 weeks. And if you still say I'm not done with hip hop, I will let it drop forever.
I'm gonna need the. Can you send me the list later?
I can.
One other thing that I was thinking about is I'm a guitar player, and I just like hearing guitars in my music. And I realize I'm generalizing. I'm sure there might be,
but there is
guitars.
There is guitars in that music.
There are guitars, I'm sure. But I just like, you know, I like hearing guitars. Like I just, you know, I, sneak preview, but you know, I just interviewed Trevor Riley from Wilhelm Scream. The guy rips. I mean, that band kills it every, you know, all the time. And I just feel like I should be listening like to them instead while I'm listening to a hip hop song. But I will listen.
I'm not trying
to
diss
listen to these,
Ricky,
though. I will listen.
But,
to
I mean, those guys blow Beardo Punk out of the water, man. I mean, they really do. But listen, I mean, it's a different genre. You know, not everything has to be guitar.
No, I know.
Not everything has to be hip-hop, you know. Not everything has to be reggae. Variety truly is the spice of life.
No, I'm open to this.
If I could just get my two cents in real quick. First thing, John, with the album recommendations, definitely the first four are
good. Oh, you don't like Mr. Scarface?
He's like, you know. To be honest with you, I don't really know Scarface that well. But definitely the first four I could get behind because of, you know, what they mean. And, you know, again, all before 1995. So definitely could get on the same wavelength. But kind of to Ricky and Adam's point, Adam, more like, you know, getting away from people that you didn't like and what they listen to. And then Ricky, man, I just, my parents listen to like disco and stuff. And I wanted to hear a guitar real bad. And once I kind of started hearing a guitar, I got hooked. So that's what kind of, those two things kind of drew me away from hip hop because I listened to it a lot more when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And that was because more like my family and my sister listened to it. And I was into it too. And I do still appreciate a lot of the older albums. But yeah, as time went on, I appreciated it less. And it also changed. There's a whole, we do a whole nother show on that. But just my two cents.
Mm-hmm.
John, that was way less painful than I thought it was going to be.
Me too. I thought the same thing.
Well, I honestly thought Ricky might be having an issue that would be fairly unique to him. I realize I'm being cryptic, but I guess there's not that issue.
No.
So that's why I thought it was going to be more painful. Ricky, do you know the issue that I'm talking about?
I think so.
We'll talk about it after the podcast. Fine. I don't want to bring it up because and people think, well, what's wrong with Ricky? It's not. It's actually not on Ricky's side. It's actually on the hip hop side, which would make Ricky not a fan.
Oh, maybe so. I would. Maybe I don't know then. Okay, no.
I'll just say
No. Don't.
No, I'll say some hip hop.
No,
not
no,
all
no,
hip hop.
No, John, I'd rather you didn't.
Uh oh.
Just wait.
Fair enough.
So plug it up.
Thank you.
Well, there we go. Adam White, on the pain meeting, where does that rank on the pain scale?
I was literally going to go try to find like a some sort of multiplayer game that me and Ricky could play as you talked at us about hip hop for 40 minutes. But I didn't have to do that. So that was good. John, I know you only want the best for everyone and you're just trying to spread the love and the education. And that's cool. I'm good with that. That wasn't painful.
I'm just trying to spread the love.
I can't undrink the liquor that I've drank to get to this point though. So we're just going to ride that. But yeah.
Well, listen. Speaking of cultural issues, there was a big cultural issue down in Philadelphia last week at This Is Hardcore Fest. And actually, I specifically did not do a news post about this because I didn't think it was news, but maybe Chris Barrett will disagree with me. I was at This Is Hardcore Fest, a huge hardcore festival in Philadelphia every year. They have a lot of returning legacy acts and they have a lot of new acts. I only was there on Saturday. I wish I went on Sunday. No, I was there on Friday. I saw Integrity. Integrity was amazing. I saw Ringworm. Ringworm was really cool. I saw a couple other bands. I think it was Saturday, Gorilla Biscuits played. As a side note, they came out to a trumpet player. That trumpet player was Chris Culp of Mischief Brew. And they basically just called him up and said, Chris, will you come out and do our intro playing your trumpet? And he did, and it was a lot of fun. However, there was a part of the Gorilla Biscuit show that a lot of people say were not fun. There was an issue with regards to the Black Lives Matter movement. Basically, what happens was the singer of Gorilla Biscuits, I think his name's Walter, said following...
No, Arthur Civarelli.
Oh, Arthur, you're right, Civ, I'm sorry. Here's what he came out and he said this mid-concert and it caused quite the uproar, both positive and negative, a big divide. He says, in 2006, people still, this is Civ speaking of Gorilla Biscuits, in 2006, people still have, oh, I saw Career Suicide too. Career Suicide was awesome. Anyway, he said, in 2016, people still have to wear shirts that say Black Lives Matter. No shit. Brown, white, yellow, black, we all effing matter. Everybody here matters. Do not let the media, schools, institutions influence you. We are one family, one people. And then they started playing the song Degradation, which is a anti-racism song. He got a lot of blowback from that. People saying that it was, I want to say racist of him to say that. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, a lot of people have different opinions. So on Facebook, here's what he said after all this all went down. I'm surprised that this was taken in any other way than it was intended. My point was, and I thought it was clear that in 2016, we as people should not need such things to be on a shirt, and they should be universal truths. We are all in this together. If you know the band and the lyrics and what we have always stood for, this should be clear. Also, look at the lyrics, degradation, and things we say, especially the line, some people are so quick to judge, let's get the judgment straight. Chris, you specifically wanted to be on the podcast this week to talk about this issue. The floor is yours.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess to put it this way, I'm glad you read the what he said and then what his Facebook post was, because I'll give him two things. I'll give him the fact he said what he said, fine, and then what he said on the Facebook post, he cleared up what he said, but more doubled down on what he said. And so I guess there's a few really important things to understand, and what people got upset about. Rightfully and wrongfully, and John, maybe the argument might be what you think it is, and maybe what you might not think it is. But essentially, yes, he did say all lives matter, and which, in theory, yeah, that's absolutely true. I can't get into Sib's operation of thinking, but judging by his lyrics and what he said on stage, because I saw him, I've only seen him once. I saw him a few years ago here in New York. They played House of Vans. I think it was like was it 2013, 2014. I don't remember off the top of my head. And, you know, so I've heard his stage banter and whatever. And he's definitely got a positive message, a message of unity. Then gets a little old man hardcore, kind of like, you know, like people are really sensitive about things that they say and it's not the way it used to be. Like he did get into that too on stage. Aside from that, though, back to the issue. The issue with All Lives Matter is that, while technically, yes, correct, what he essentially said at the beginning when he says, you know, it's 2016, we shouldn't need shirts that say Black Lives Matter, no shit. His intention wasn't negative. But when you say something like All Lives Matter, it marginalizes the Black Lives Matter movement. And the greatest example out there is a lot of times when it comes to, you know, if you're at a fundraiser for a cause. Like, you know, I've had family, like my mother passed away from lupus, or I've had a family member pass away from breast cancer. If you're at one cause and then someone comes in and says, all causes matter, you know, maybe not the best analogy, but the best analogy that is often put out there. So much that it is true, yes, but the purpose of the movement, it's a direct response to, you know, being a person of color, African American in particular. I'm half Black, for those who don't know, and but I appear more white. So half my family, you know, dealing with, you know, potentially, you know, excessive force by the police over generally, benign, like, you know, traffic stop and frisk. It goes into a whole issue. And what he did, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, I don't know about his operation of mind, is that he kind of, you know, pushed it aside and said, you know, well, you know, everybody matters, unity. And it's like, great, I understand. Unity is a great message. But the thing is that to directly kind of retort to that is that's the problem. And that, and it's not that, you know, to say that he's racist, I don't think is accurate. And I think, you know, where people throw out the term racist too easy and too much, I have a whole theory about race, racism and things that are racially insensitive. This would probably fall under more racially insensitive. And just more ignorant. Ignorant and racism, like if you're a racist, you're ignorant too. But if you're ignorant, it doesn't necessarily mean you're racist. And he's kind of ignorant to the purpose of that issue by saying what he said and then doubling down on what he said. I get the message of unity, but the problem is there's a purpose to the movement. And maybe there are some in the movement who take it to the next level, but there's a purpose to the movement. And for him to kind of, hey, if you're going to address it, know what you're talking about. He clearly doesn't know what he's talking about. So that's why, and last point, I think Turning Point played the next day or later that night. I don't know. I wasn't at This Is Hardcore. And the singer came out and basically kind of indirectly ripped Siv for saying it. Like, you know, you used to spot, you know, kind of ignorant or racist people, you know, by what they were wearing at the shows in the 90s. But now they kind of hide with their certain jobs and then kind of with things where they say all lives matter. So I don't think it was necessarily racist. There is a little controversy more in the sense that you can't be any more tone deaf and then be more public about it. So if you're not sure what you're saying about, don't say it. That's what I really have to say about that. So, John, I think you said you might disagree, or I'm not sure.
Well, I agree with what you're saying. Mostly, I disagree a little bit, but I think maybe we'll just let Chris have the floor And let that be that. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, cool yeah, I mean, if you just want to let it be, that's cool. I mean, you know, again, I have Gorilla Biscuit stuff too, and I'm a person of color. So am I going to throw out the start today? No. Am I going to throw out the 7-inch? No. It just more as a manifestation of, you know, an ignorance more than anything. Maybe, hopefully, his next statement, he'll kind of understand more what he's talking about when he's talking about it. That's really it. So, all right. So let's move on to some more cogent matters.
Well, by more cogent matters, we mean a song by, well, not by, but introduced by Mr. Ricky Frankel. Yeah. So,
nice use of cogent, Chris. Well done.
Thank you.
So a few weeks ago, we talked about the Pears offshoot band that was before Pears, but it was a bunch of, it was like three out of the four guys in Pears now were in this band called Little Bags and Community Records, a New Orleans-based label. They released Little Bags album on cassette. When we had talked about it, though, it had not been out yet. So I got a hold of it like a day or two later after that episode. So I'm going to be playing a song from the self-titled album from Little Bags. The song's called Lay Low. Check out and also it's actually kind of appropriate that we play it because the review of it went up on Punk News and it got an 8 out of 10, which I agree with. It's actually quite good. If you're a fan of Pears, or if you're not a fan of Pears, regardless, I think you should definitely check this out because it does show what else these guys can do and how much musical range they have, not just the crazy shit they do on Green Star or Go to Prison. So again, this is Lay Low by Little Bags.
We're back. That was Little Bags. John, we're gonna just start blasting through some of these stories because we have a whole bunch of them. So I'll read the first, you take the next, we'll just trade off.
Let's smash them down, baby.
Yeah,
smash them down,
you know, Chris, Ricky, hop in and comment on these as you see fit, because there's all kinds of wackiness that happened this past week. This one is it's one that we see something like this pop up every few years. There is some fashion designer that tries to make I'll just read the story. This seems just like a recurring theme during my years on Punk News. So the high-end fashion retailer Barney's New York is now offering a line of punk rock t-shirts. The shirts cost $265 or $175 each. Which is about $4 million Canadian. The listing says that the shirts are distressed, And they include several bands you've probably heard of. So there are shirts in the line with the Black Flag logo on it. They have a Joy Division shirt, a shirt for The Cure, a Ramones shirt, a Motorhead one, and a bunch of others. So you can find a link to these and the listings and everything for them over on Punk News. And you can actually go check out on their website the some of the details of these fine products if you wish to go purchase one of them. But they are they're definitely turning a lot of heads online. I've seen these things mentioned all over the damn place recently. So
because of us, mind you, but nobody gave us credit.
Was it because of us? Because I was never us that I saw linked anywhere.
It was me because I was looking at something completely unrelated, and I happened to be on Barney's because I was doing research for my real job, and I saw a research. Black Flag shirt. Yeah, I was buying stuff at Barney's, and I can't. I'm like, is that a Black Flag shirt? And it was, but not a single website gave us credit.
Oh, really?
Really?
So, anyways, that sucks. But you know, so John, I'm looking at our link to this doesn't really work anymore because the
they might have took it down.
I don't know. Well, no, their whole website's kind of fucked up when I try to go to that link moment. So, anyways, I'm trying to read the description, which is a little bit fuzzied out in our screenshot here. Let's see here. So it says, crafted of black or acid, what is it? Japanese cotton cashmere.
Jersey.
Yeah, all right. So outside of the fact that this is a $300 Black Flag shirt, is it? I'm not aware of the prices of different textiles or anything like that. It's not really my area of expertise. But like, are these woven out of solid gold? Is there?
No, it's 95% cotton, 5% cashmere. That 5% cashmere, that's really what brings up the price.
Is that worth $300?
Well, if you add the 100% platinum to it, that's where you get the $300. Actually, I wish this is the only time I wish we had I would say put like a tag underneath, file under edgy. How much does edgy cost? I'm sure it actually feels comfortable and probably fits good, but really? $265? Really? Come on.
Well, I guess the question I have is this worth getting upset over? I mean, when I first saw this, I'm like, this is stupid.
Yeah, I thought it was funny.
I'm assuming if the shirts are licensed, then that means suckers are paying money to bands, which I'm all for, you know. But on the other hand, to a degree, it is the selling out of a culture in that, you know, this is mainstream people that are buying these shirts. You know, I mean, beyond mainstream, this is, you know, high-end fashion people spending what kind of idiot spends $265 for a shirt? That's stupid. And that shows the gluttony of the United States to a degree, in that can some people buy $265 t-shirts, but some people, you know, can't even afford a dollar shirt at Goodwill? Like, this is ridiculous. But further to that, it does represent to a degree, and I sort of agree with this, an attack on a culture, and that, you know, the mainstream or super high-end mainstream, you know, see something, they consume it, and then they destroy it, and then it's no longer there for us. So is the fault for us at not being able to protect this culture? Does this mean that our culture doesn't even mean what we thought it meant to begin with, if it can be so easily manipulated? Or is it just a one-off thing that just happens every once and now and again? I would like to ask the person that buys these, why are you buying these? Like no one that's a huge fan of Black Flag is going to spend $25 for a Black Flag shirt because it's a waste of money. So look, like, you know, there's that Kim Kardashian photo wearing a municipal waste leather jacket, and there's that Chris Brown where he's got a Cro-Mags leather jacket. It's like, what are you trying to effectuate by wearing that? And in a way, and I think you can quite clearly say this is high-end fashion people essentially wear costumes, which is cool. I think it's neat when people wear costumes, if you will, because it's interesting looking. So in a way, they're just wearing a costume without any meaning behind the costume. It's almost as if they're wearing an artifact without understanding what the artifact means, simply because that's what they do in high-end. They wear costumes, and this is just the latest costume. So is this worth getting mad about? I don't know. Maybe.
Could I pose one quick question? Does it show like the like, quote unquote, punk chic is in? Because that's what me and Sam, my wife, you know, talked about on a regular, is like the edgy, like, punk chic being in. You know, Chris Brown wears municipal waste, has no idea what it is. You know, just
does he even know what punk is?
No, and probably not. It's just the chic, you know, it's just like the edgy look that's in. That's what I was trying to get at. Like, I think it's more like something like that. And I think that's something worth kind of giving a few moments for, but it's not the end of the world, but it's something to think about.
Listen, you know? I don't think there's anything worse than last year. This is not worse than when, remember the Sex Pistols credit card came out? Like, that was, I think that was way worse than this. And also, like, did we ever find out where these were made?
Yes, Italy. So at least they're not sweatshop.
Interesting. An Italian-made Black Flag shirt.
Well, the shirts are made in Italy. The Black Flag might be at it in America. I suspect it is.
I was going to hope there was a side of pasta with that or something. You know?
There is an intersection of like five different things I genuinely don't understand on this story. The one is that I was going to say I partially understand the idea of owning, say, like high-priced menswear, but only in the, but not like a high-priced Black Flag shirt. That doesn't make sense. Like my example for this is that, like, I have a business partner. He owns a handful of, they're just, I don't know, they're just like buttoned up men's shirts, but they have these wacky looking paisley kind of patterns on them, and they're apparently by some fashion company or label or whatever that is known. And I don't know what they are. I just think they're weird shirts. But
do they look better?
They look like, they don't look like they're made of garbage like all of my clothing. But even like the equivalent, like, you know, formal wear that I have, which is all made of garbage. But he's been to like, you know, some sort of like business event or something like that before in Toronto, where people have walked up to him who have been these, I imagine them being hoity-toity people that have like monocles in, and the monocle people have been like, oh, you're wearing one of those shirts. Like, we know the designer just by looking at the shirt. So clearly, if you're going to try to run in those circles, or you have to run in those circles, that there is some degree to which, you know, this expensive fashion that you're wearing can project something which can be socially useful for you. Like, I get that. I don't want to shit on the whole idea of fashion, but that's wearing a shirt that's clearly been designed by, I don't know, according to this certain style or to have a certain look. Like, someone could look across the room and go, oh, that's one of those shirts. If you walk in with a fucking black shirt that says Black Flag on it, no one is going to know that that was a $700 version necessarily, or the $15 version that you bought at a mall kiosk. So,
or the $10 version that you buy from Mike V, but he tries to rip you off for $10 and acts like he forgot to give you your change until you remind him, please give me my change, Mike V.
Yeah, Mike V. So in that case, that seems a little like I can't quite make the connection between like, oh, okay, I understand the social relevancy of sometimes having to look proper. Like, that doesn't fit when it comes to a super expensive Black Flag shirt. But now I'm looking around on the Barney's New York website, and I don't really know anything about this company or anything, apparently, because I'm looking at one of the things they sell, and they are selling a flannel shirt with the sleeves cut off, which, like, it's like a faux grunge kind of thing, for $700. But now I'm reading the description of it, and it is a one that there is co-branded with Justin Bieber for some reason. And now I realize that, like, this is like looking at alien culture to me, because I have no idea how this computes to anyone. Why would anyone buy this?
Edgy.
I'm kind of convinced they don't really sell them. It's just like a website, right?
How about the Freddy Krueger shirt? No one mentioned the Freddy Krueger shirt.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. But John, this whole thing has got me down a really cool, internet side hole here. So I'm on a website right now called Mongolian Economy .mn.
Oh my god!
And it's because I was trying to find the market price of cashmere to see if it would justify the shirts being $300. So this is an article from the Mongolian Economy website, which says cashmere price has hit the ground, and it's from a little while ago. But that's not important. What's important is that there's this giant fucking crazy Mongolian horse goat that is the picture on the page here. And I'm looking at this and thinking, I don't actually know what cashmere is or what it comes from. Does it come from this horrible monster goat? And I'm following down that rabbit hole, and I'm over on Wikipedia, and yeah, there's something called a cashmere goat. Did you know that, John?
Honestly, I did not know that.
Where'd you think cashmere came from? I don't know what it was.
Well, I knew it was a wool, so I just thought it was like especially good wool, you know?
There's a whole world of goats that I was not previously aware of that I need to go look into now.
Set up a GoFundMe page for the goats.
Well, I'll tell you what. Speaking of investigations and and finer things.
Yeah, seg out of that.
So speaking of wonderful, expensive things, actually, this is very cheap. Kicker. They've announced their second album. Who's Kicker? Somebody asked me, who's Kicker?
Who's Kicker?
Kicker is like one of my favorite bands. Kicker is a band composed of punk veterans. Pete DeRoti, who we've interviewed before. Pete has roadied for Amoebix, Subhumans, Jello Biafra, Fugazi, Shrapnel, the A-Heads. Pete has been roadieing for punk bands since 1978. He's the singer. Other guys in the band include Mouse of Dystopia, Dave Ed of Neurosis, and Toby of Submachines on the recording. And they're all punk guys that make some of the most banging UK 82 style punk rock I've ever. I mean, honestly, to be really real, I like the Subhumans. I mean, I like UK Subs a lot. I like Kicker better than I like Subhumans. UK Subs and Subhumans, honestly. I love Kicker. Kicker, they play like banging punk rock, but it's usually pretty funny. They sing about being old and, you know, eating chips, you know, French fries and that kind of thing. And I just love Kicker. So we got to debut their new song at – oh, we got to debut their new song at Punk News called Rendered Obsolete, which makes sense. And Pete, speaking to Punk News, said – we are older punk. I'm going to say Pete's heavy Cockney accent that he speaks in. We are older punks, right? We don't write songs about writing no more. We write songs about breakfast. And I just think Pete is wonderful, and you should check out this track. I don't know if you guys check out this track or not, but Kicker rules. I'm so excited for their new release.
I thought this was really cool. I think he has he's on lead vocals, right?
Pete's on vocals, yeah.
He's got a really unique voice that really kind of just kicks out at you. It was good.
If you ever get a chance to meet or talk to Pete, you definitely should. If you see Jello live, Pete's probably roadieing. If you ever at the Subhumans, Pete might be roadieing. Well, you'll know him as soon as you see him. He's this old punk guy with super spiky hair, and he's the greatest. Like he is the greatest. Pete's the man.
When I went to see Jello Biafra and the Guantanamo School of Medicine on Halloween, he was there.
That's Pete.
Yep.
God, John, your Cockney accent is giving me an ulcer. That was
right, Adam. What's the next story?
No. Oh man, and we know that British people listen to this podcast, and it makes me sad.
Right, Richard out of the UK. You tell them that my Cockney accent's just right. You won't tell them, won't you? In it,
we're getting some mail next week, right?
Yeah, if you want to hear more funny accents from John, write us a podcast at punknews.org. So Against Me have released a new track. The new song is called Haunting Haunted Haunts, and it was released over on – who released this sucker? The Adult Swim Singles Club, whatever that is. Anyways, you can find it on Punk News. It's linked there. It's going to appear on the new album Shapeshift with Me, which comes out on September 16th. So this is the second song that I think the world has heard from this record.
Roy!
Shut up. I assume you've all listened to it. So, Chris, did you check this out? What do you think?
Oh, man. You had to call me out. I actually didn't check this out. I missed this one.
It's an easy one.
I checked out the other ones, though.
I'll jump in here.
Ricky, save us.
I really like this. I think this one was... this is one of their mellower stuff. I mean, I kind of hear some of the older Against Me stuff, like pre-Sire days in this, but maybe with a little more updated edge. I'm getting more and more excited about this one. I remember being a little cautious about it, but now I think I'm all in on this next Against Me one record. The one thing I am waiting for, though, is like, where's the big hard-hitting anthem? That's the what I'm looking for now, because they do that so well, and I feel like these songs, which are great, have been not mellow, but on the mellower, somewhat mellow side of where this band, you know, we all know where they can go with, you know, transgender dysphoria blues. I mean, Walking is Still Honest, like all of those, you know, TSR, like where's the big stuff, the big grand stuff that Against Me can bring. And I'm excited to hear what they do if there are any of those songs on this album. Adam, what'd you think?
I think it's a really interesting track in that it has a certain, like, it gallops.
Yeah,
I guess is the best way to put it. There is an element of it that, and this is going to sound super weird, for whatever reason, was reminding me of Flogging Molly, but not in a Irishy way, which is potentially the weirdest way.
It does have an interesting rhythm. I'll give you that.
Yeah, like there is something about the way that this song kind of propulses itself along that, for whatever reason, I was just getting like flashes to like some early Flogging Molly stuff, and I don't really know why or if that's even the right comparison. It definitely is not doing anything. I mean, I say Flogging Molly and everyone jumps to Irish, but that wasn't really what I was trying to imply. But yeah, it's interesting. I agree with you that like I've not yet heard the big single
right.
from this record. Yeah. Like I've not yet heard anything that stands out as an anthem or anything to that stripe. And while I've enjoyed all of the Against Me songs that I've heard so far from this one, they all seem so far like an album track. Like they're not the standouts, I guess.
Yeah.
I really want to hear this record as is, because I still feel like it's being held back from me.
What I also really liked about this too was you could tell Laura lyrically kind of went kind of old style Against Me, where like she does this like she during like playing the chords, she'll like put in as many words as she can in it as possible, not really going with the rhythm, kind of straying away from it, and also not rhyming. That's something I thought she's always done really well, is writing lyrics that don't rhyme. So I was very happy with this. I think I like this one more than the other one, but again, both are great, and I'm excited.
Would you say like it's a little bit Eternal Cowboy?
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, like
which is a high point for me. Absolutely. I really like that record. Yeah. So yeah, like it would fit well in on that. And I think like what you're talking about is like Potatoes, Rice, and Bread.
Yes, yes.
I'm thinking that song. Like it kind of has that
just faster
sort of vibe. I feel like the guitar riff in this, I've heard, like the riff in the chorus, like I've heard, like it is not from another band, like from another Against Me song. Like there is something that it
just like
jumps me to
like the opening. Opening I thought was the opening was a little bit reinventing Axl Rose on an electric guitar, like not like the song, but the album.
There was something. I don't remember exactly where in the song at the moment, because it was been a little while since I listened to it. Uh-huh. But there is something in my head that, say, calls to mind, what's the name of the song? It's like Unprotected Sex with Multiple Partners, which was off of...
That's Searching.
Searching for Form of Clarity.
Yeah.
Which was off of Searching. There's a guitar part. I can't even identify where it is because I don't remember. It's probably not the chorus, as I said a second ago. There's a part to this song that just tonally really reminds me of that song, which is interesting because I really don't like that song. So, but it works better here. But I came off of this and that other one was stuck in my head. It's cool. I'm still not hearing where the big single is from this, but right. Maybe that doesn't matter.
Well, I think we talked about this last time, where this band, we've kind of noticed, like, doesn't really put those out immediately. You know,
yeah, either on purpose or they're just bad at it. one or the other. John, do you have any Against Me thoughts?
Right. Well,
no, don't do that to our precious listeners.
Honestly, like I was never really an Against Me fan. I actually became somewhat of a fan with Transgender Dysphoria Blues. I thought that was a fantastic record. Considering the topic of the record, but also even not considering the topic of the record, just as a straight up punk record, yeah. I thought it was an excellent record. This record so far has been a little bit too mid tempo for me, a little bit too slow, not enough womp. And I'm always amazed that this is a gentle sounding record so far, which is fine. That's people want. That's fine. This record is not challenging me that much. It's not that every record has to challenge me, but I do get frustrated in punk rock when we have these far out weirdo bands and people just say, this is stupid, I hate that. And then we hear something Against Me, which we've heard this before, and people are like, oh, this is so great. And I get frustrated with regards to that. It's not Against Me's fault, mind you. So far, I think I'm going to take a pass on this record. I do not find this to be that exciting, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how the rest of it all comes together, because it is so far, and this is I guess what you and Ricky were getting at is that I'm not sure what the feel is of this one. I'm not sure what the character of this record is yet. And after hearing two songs, that's kind of interesting. So
is it still lo-fi like Transgender Dysphoria Blues? And also, too, do you think it's...
See, I don't even think that record was lo-fi. I thought that record was a punk record. It sounded like Circle Jerks Group Sex to me. I'm like, it sounds like a live record.
Yeah, I mean, it was raw, but it was it was really raw. I mean
it wasn't Blink 182 like super produced.
Well, I mean, we're not necessarily looking for that, but I mean, Ricky, help me out. I mean, you know what I mean, right?
if you compare Transgender Dysphoria Blues to the others, I mean, I don't think you can get more produced in the Against Me discography than White Crosses. I think they brought it.
Right.
I think they brought it down a notch with. I think they hit it just. Actually, I think they got it just right for as big as they were with Transgender Dysphoria Blues production wise. This one, I don't know. I mean, this one right now, it seems like it could be maybe a little more than Transgender Dysphoria Blues. I don't know yet. You can't judge it on two songs. That's the thing, and you can't judge it on the.
You really can't judge it on this song,
because not this song.
This song is just
on
is, it's yeah. It doesn't have that kind of like that big chorus or anything where the amount of vocal production in particular would really stick out on you. So
I mean, I'm excited. I'm waiting for that for those songs though.
Can there be a strategy to holding back on the real whammers till right before the album comes out? Like, is that a strategy that could conceivably work?
I mean, maybe if so, like, fans don't get sick of it as fast because they all know that they're going to be streaming that one song when it gets premiered over and over and over again. I mean, maybe, but still, like, don't you want to get people as excited for the album as possible so you can get as many pre-orders as possible?
Yeah, you don't want people, like I remember when Rancid, when they were streaming their last record, I literally canceled my pre-order because I was so, their stream did the opposite of what it was supposed to do. I had pre-order for the record for like a $30 version of the record. And the songs were so uninteresting, I canceled my record. So you really want to hook people in with the whammers. I don't see any real strategy by not leading, at least with the first one. Maybe you could lead with a whammer and then do like a melancholy or mid-tempo one. But I think you got to start out with a kicker, you know?
Wait, quick poll. Okay, so just last thing I got to say. Are you guys, all of you, would you rather... the kicker come out and then be what annoys you more? The kicker comes out and then you're disappointed with the rest of the record, or that they put out something that is the most forgettable song and then you're pleasantly surprised later?
I'll take choice number two.
But that's gambling that you've got a crappy record.
Yeah, see? So you're not sure. You gotta toe the fence. You're like,
You see, but it depends on the band, because I'll take that too. Gamble on like if and we're almost there. But if every song that I heard in the lead up to this Against Me record was a little bit forgettable, which is kind of the reality, I'm still gonna go check out that Against Me record because I really love that band. If it was some band I've never heard before, it was some band's first record, then, you know, do the opposite, right?
Well,
get people hooked on that big single, right?
But you know what I mean. Kind of like John's example with Rancid, more so. So a band you know, band you're familiar with. Maybe not your favorite band, but a band you're familiar with, maybe have an album or two.
I mean, I think bands reveal a little bit too much at this point. Coming back to like that Rancid example, like, if you're Rancid, especially at this point in their career, there's a certain group of people that are going to buy your record, and there's maybe people like John that are going to be a little bit on the fence about it, but would probably buy it on faith having not heard it. but then you go and play too much of it and it sucks, and then, you know, I mean, I guess you're doing them a service because they didn't have to buy your sucky record. But on the other hand,
at least they responded.
Maybe you shouldn't have made a sucky record. Hopefully, speaking of something that doesn't suck, play a song, Chris.
All right. So last time I introduced a song, I did a bad job. So this time I'm introducing a song.
Chris, you really did. I mean, Chris, I like you a lot. You're a great guy. But last time you introduced a song that didn't even exist.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's pretty hard.
It was a joke. And it went poorly, like many of my jokes. But that's okay. That's just how life goes sometimes.
That's okay. Why we love you, Chris. You're real. That's why we love you. No Tony Dance.
All right. So, well, this one I'm going to throw at you guys. Released this year from a band called Resolutions. They're from Germany, Hanover, Germany. They put out a split last year with a good friend of mine, great band too. We streamed their record this year. They did a split with Up For Nothing last year. I suggest go checking that out. But the song on this album, the song's called Machines, and the album is called Weightless. And it came out on Fonda Life Records, I think about 2 months ago. So highly recommend checking it out. And definitely real jammer this year, kind of underrated. So here we have Machines from Resolutions.
And we are back, and we're going to talk about probably my favorite subject to cover in punk news, Morrissey.
Boo.
Morrissey yet again is in the news, and I mean, I think the guy is great. But today, the Smiths and Morrissey and PETA released something that I don't think anybody saw coming. Adam, what did you see this coming?
I wasn't aware of it. It wasn't being heralded on the breeze or anything the morning I woke up. But
unlike Rance's months and months of preview for their record, out of the blue, the Smiths released a video game in conjunction with PETA and game developer This Is Pop. And of course, really, it's not like the Smiths got together to let's release a video game. PETA probably reached out to the Smiths and said, can we slap your name on this? The game is called This Beautiful Creature Must Die, named after a lyric from the song Meat Is Murder. There's an album called Meat Is Murder 2 by the Smiths. And the game is kind of weird because it's got these cutesy animals, like really cute, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Affected looking animals, you know, kind of like almost anime-ish, I guess, or 8-bit anyway, flying towards these spinning saw blades, and you have to shoot the animal with a flying rainbow turkey, and if you miss the animal, then they get cut in half by the saw blades, and you lose. And the game, of course, is in protest of eating meat, but more specifically, slaughterhouse conditions. And Morrissey, who I think is great, people hate this quote. I think this is probably one of the greatest quotes I've read this year. Regarding the game, Morrissey said, "This game is the biggest social crusade of all, as we safeguard the weak and helpless from the violent human aggression. You don't get that from Pokemon Go," which I thought was great. This game is – did not see this coming. It's interesting.
This game was hard, man. I tried it. It was really difficult.
Well, Ricky, man, what do you think of the game? What do you think of Morrissey's quote?
Oh, everyone knows what my stance on Morrissey. I don't like him. This game is this. I don't.
But don't you at least respect him for at least being so true to his values? Like, I mean, if you look at Frank Turner, if you look at Rancid, they're not going to get up there and say anything controversial. Meanwhile, Morrissey, who has a lot of money on the line, will get up there and say things that definitely will alienate people. However, but don't you respect that, though?
I respect him as I respect his influence as a musician.
Don't you respect his balls, though, that he's willing to put
it's
his
It's getting life old, man. How, I mean, I get he has convictions.
He believes in it.
I get that, but, like, this game isn't going to make me stop eating my dinner.
No, this game's not going to make
in a minute. If anything, I mean, like, even, I mean, people were actually talking about, in the comments, were talking about how funny this game actually is.
Yeah, it's weird. It's so cute,
this,
you know?
This got probably some unintended blowback. Yeah, I don't like Morrissey. I don't know what else to say. Like, you know, dude, like, I guess do what you gotta do. Just stop, trying. Some people were talking about like shaming people, like how they didn't like how people like try and shame others into not eating meat and like how that's not a good way of like getting people to not eat that, which I thought was kind of interesting. I think that was in the comments too, but, this, you know what? I don't play Pokemon Go. And that's not going to make me, like, change. That's not really going to change. I don't think that game would change my behavior, and nor will this game. So, I don't know, Morrissey, you know, leave me alone.
I mean, to John's point, actually, it was more of, you know, he puts his beliefs on the line. And I totally understand that. I'm not a Morrissey fan either. He puts his beliefs on the line. The only thing is that, I mean, it's well documented, you know, his activism for animal rights. So it's not anything, it's not a new topic,
right,
or something that's, you know, like a burgeoning issue. Like the whole Civ with the Black Lives Matter thing was actually a little bit more like something hot right now. I mean, you know, a whole like veganism battle from PETA, you know, I mean, that's what PETA's about. And that's what's been going on for however long. So every once in a while, I mean, to me, this is just more like a way for PETA to kind of keep fresh and kind of jump in on something. I guess the specific reference to Pokemon Go, to me, would that indicate? Yeah, it was funny. But to me, it indicates that since mindless games are hot right now, why don't you play a mindful game? Something that makes you think while you're playing and kind of cash, you know, quote unquote, cashing in on like a game craze right now. But Pokemon Go, it's a nostalgia craze that happens to sync with GPS technology, and like it's a weird phenomenon. It's like a perfect storm. This is just something that, you know, you just kind of like, oh, this is funny, and then about 10 minutes later you forget it. So,
well, see, that's why I think Morrissey is so great, and Morrissey is so punk rock, and people never acknowledge how punk rock Morrissey is. He's saying that you are being controlled by large corporations and being made dumb by large corporations. Do something about it. Do something that's not making you dumber. Morrissey is so punk rock.
I don't. Here's the thing. I don't need to be condescended to by the ex leader of the Smiths to know this stuff, though. Like, that's my problem. It's not even what he's saying that's the problem I have. It's how he says it. He is so condescending and pretentious, I just automatically write him off. That's the problem.
Well, there's something to be said for that.
Like, say what you believe. That's fine, but it's how you say it that's going to drive people either to you or away.
I don't think it's... Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying, Ricky. I don't even think it's so much that... I mean, I eat meat as well. And this does not affect me eating meat or not, or make me hate him more. It's just more to John's point. Just like, I don't think that particular thought that you put out there, in terms of like, you know, being controlled by corporations and games, is more of the point of it. I think it's just more direct in terms of the meat, not meat. You know, the PETA message more than the gaming point.
Yeah, well, I mean, truthfully, I think what I said is there to a degree.
Oh, yeah, no, I understand.
I agree. I think he's just taking a fun shot at Pokemon Go because he likes to take shots at things.
Yeah, you know? Oh, yeah.
Oh, I got absolutely. That too, yeah.
Absolutely.
Right. I will not talk about PETA. I don't want to talk about PETA. I've made that vow. I don't want to talk about PETA because, like, man, fuck PETA. But, I'm so torn on my Morrissey my Morrissey opinion here, because on the one hand, John, I usually come down on your side about this type of thing, where I want Maz to just like let his freak flag fly and just like be as maximum Maz as possible, and whatever crazy shit is going to come out of his mouth at any given time, like I'm all for it, because I like having that color interjected into my universe. But on the other hand, I'm a little bit worried that opinion infantilizes him. where I don't actually take him seriously.
He does that himself.
And he takes this shit seriously. But I keep going like, oh, Morrissey, you know, you lovable scamp, whatever you're going to say, we still love you. You know, I'm sure that's not, you know, I'm sure that if me and him were to have a conversation about that, he would, you know, tell me where to shove it. So but that's how I always approach it. So I don't quite know how to square the fact that I don't take Morrissey seriously with the fact that I kind of am charmed by Morrissey being maximum Morrissey. It's a weird relationship.
You've got a weird relationship with Morrissey, you're saying?
I have a weird relationship with Morrissey, yeah. That said, we have this weird relationship because it's his fault, not mine. So, right, like, I didn't make shit weird. I'm just trying to make some peace with the fact that he made shit weird. So I don't know. I don't know what to say about this game. You know, if you want to be veg or vegan or whatever, you know, that's probably better for the earth. So all the power to you. If you want to affect, you know, change that actually, you know, that creates positive change for animal welfare and things like that. I mean, unfortunately, my opinion on that is that you're probably better to not approach the issues in these big, loud, ham-fisted ways that PETA always tends to, and that you could be doing a lot more for a lot more animals by not associating yourself with the biggest, loudest, dumbest voice in the room on the topic. But hey, whatever, you know. Fight the fight however you'd like, I guess. Oh, I talked about PETA. Fucking John, that was not what I wanted to do.
You said you wouldn't talk about PETA.
I didn't want to talk about PETA.
But you did.
They're gonna come after me. They're crazy. You don't understand.
Yeah, but Adam, like, what if like next week we go to Punk News and like the headline is Morrissey trashes Adam White for his views on PETA? How great would that be?
You know what? I could probably get like Twitter verified after that, because I could be like, hey, I'm that guy that Maz is trashing. You got to differentiate me. So maybe there'd be some good for it. I don't know. Anyways, I don't want Morrissey to be mad at me, John. I don't want his ire, because he has so much.
He can be mad at me. That's why he's punk rock. He's got a lot of anger.
I don't know if I can deal with someone's inexhaustible ire. I just want to stay away from that. So speaking of
inexhaustible,
shit, I don't know. Speaking of crazy shit, Dio is back.
But how?
So last Saturday, Ronnie James Dio made his return from the grave as a hologram. So this was at the, I assume it's Wacken, but there's maybe a German way to say that.
Wacken.
So at Wacken sounds better. Okay. At the Wacken Open Air Music Festival in Germany, Dio appeared as a hologram. And then, this attributes way more agency to the hologram, played with his still living bandmates. So, his still living bandmates played a show. As a hologram was projected, the hologram did not play with the bandmates. That attributes way too much, you know, consciousness to this hologram. But anyways, you can go to Punk News and find this a picture of hologram Dio. It's kind of eerie. It has that
Uncanny Valley. It looks a little creepy.
It has that like early CGI, like this has clearly been cut out and superimposed on something sense to it. The microphone stand is also a hologram, as is the, it looks like, as is the cloth that's on the ground. Like, it's weird. It looks,
oh, like, I thought that was like a projector or something.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. It's, there's some weird perspective happening here. Nothing in that picture looks real. So Dio passed away in 2010. The band is planning an international tour with the hologram of their dead singer in 2017. Now, this previously happened at what? Coachella, yeah, when they Tupac. Had Tupac?
Yeah. Tupac come out? And Eazy-E, and there's been one other one too, I think.
Yeah, so welcome to your shitty future.
Yeah, seriously.
I mean, I'll say this. So, I mean, I love Nirvana, and I never saw Nirvana live because, like, Kurt Cobain was, I was like 8 when Kurt Cobain died. But, I mean, is this going to be the thing where bands are going to be able to tour with hologram bandmates? And like bands that you'd never thought could ever play again, like does Sublime need Rome anymore? I mean, just bring back the hologram Brian Orwell, and there you go. You know, it's like, you know, who needs Batfish? That would Batfish that business, man. Jobs are at stake here. You know, this is a real threat to this is a threat to our future.
Threat to Rome's job.
Rome enacts legislation. He's like, Mr. Senator, you need to enact anti-hologram legislation right now. They want our jobs.
I mean, I can't stop laughing at this picture either. I mean, I know, you know, rest in peace, Dio, but oh God, so creepy. It's so creepy.
Well, so what I don't get is, I don't get how doing this more than like, all right, I understand doing this once just sort of as some sort of morbid art project, but why would you tour with it?
And to that point, like, how much do you charge per ticket for a hologram?
How do you break down the how do you split the cost?
Like, exactly. There's like, so many questions here.
Well, no, but like, here's my question. Let's say you are the drummer for Dio here, and
you're a holo Dio.
No, for you are the human drummer that is drumming behind hologram Dio, right? All of your artistic agency is taken away from you at this point, for the most part, because you know you can't play like a slightly longer fill than you were planning to, because fucking hologram Dio is not gonna wait for your cool fill to end. He's gonna keep singing because he's a recording. So yeah. It's like reverse karaoke in a way, where you've got to just be like playing your own songs to a fucking click track to keep everything right in time sync with what the hologram is going to do. Which, I mean, again, you do it once or twice, and there's like, I'm sure there's like a super, it's super surreal, but they're gonna take it on tour. Like,
there's no room to improvise at all during the show, so every show will be like exactly the same.
Yeah, but like, and more, I mean, and I'm not saying that like Dio's going to go out there and like, you know, play like syncopathic jazz or something. Like, they don't need they're going to stay on point even if there was, say, the real Dio with them. But they're not going to stay on point to the crazy degree that you have to keep in sync with a recording. I mean, yeah. That's just, it seems like as a musician that would not be your sweet spot.
No. Two real questions. One is, you know, how will the stage banter be affected? And two, you know, when that guy needs to scream the song that he wants to hear, I mean, how is Hologram Dio going to respond? Like,
there are algorithms for this, Chris. Come on.
Actually,
has this been accounted for?
Hypothetically, you could. I think it'd be pretty easy to make Holo Dio able to take requests, so long as the requests are already in his pre-recorded system. You know what I mean? Like, you could hit a button and then he would do this song. But I mean, this is clearly hollow. This is quite morbid.
Yeah.
And you know, this is being commissioned at least in part by Dio's wife or his widow. And to a degree, I have sympathy for that. Well, you know, she needs an income stream. You know, and this is a way to make money. The guys in the band need a way to make money. But somewhere you got to cross the line. Like, where is it unnatural and unhealthy to, quote, bring back the dead? And I think holograms are it. I don't think this is healthy. There's other ways for the musicians to make money. There's other ways for Dio's wife to make money. I mean, she still has the catalog, mind you. So I think this is unhealthy. I think it's a little bit exploitative. It'd be interesting to see if Dio would have wanted this or not.
There's one way that I will fully support this. And that is if the hologram Dio was like 40 feet tall.
Godzilla Dio?
Yeah, because there's no, it's a hologram. You don't need it to be like, I don't know how tall is Dio, like 4.5 feet tall or something, right?
Dio is famously short. Yeah.
Right. So you don't need to have like a 4.5 foot tall Dio. You could make him like, you know, make him 35 feet tall and just have him stomp around and be gigantic. And now you have a spectacle, right? Now you don't have this weird touring hologram project. You have something that's really fucked up and I would pay to go see.
You could see him in the nosebleeds now.
Well, there you go. Speaking of things that are back from the dead, Lemmy Kilmister, he's back too, in slot machine form. There's going to be a video slot machine of Motorhead, and I think it's called – I don't know what the machine's called. Anyway, the machine plays Motorhead songs and is being made by Swedish casino game developer NetEnt. And this is what their merchandising person said. The Motorhead brand is synonymous with high octane music and has one of the last real iconic logos in music, which seems – she's not really addressing why they're doing it. She's basically saying we can make money off this. That's why we're doing it. However, in the company's defense, Lemmy Kilmister famously was a fan of slot machines and loved playing slot machines. I think this is a novelty. I wonder how much Motorhead's making off of it. But, listen – it's not like Motorhead was like crass and they said we won't license our stuff out. But, I mean, they license their stuff to all kinds of things. Adam White, will you be plunking your coin down in the Motorhead slot machine?
I have always had a I don't have a particular problem with gambling or anything like that. Like, babe, by all means, if that's if you're not addicted to it, then do what makes you happy. There is a part of me that has always had when I am gambling, for example, an aversion to anything that's one of these video machines. And I'm not talking about, I don't know if this is meant to be like a video slot machine that will be like in a casino or one of those like on the bar video gambling machines that exists in certain bars. I don't know if that's what the intent of this thing is, but let's assume it's one that's in a casino. For some reason, playing a machine that is a video one, as opposed to one that has like the little mechanical moving rollers in them, even though I know that they're all run by the same sort of circuit board and that it's all just artifice, I need that level of artificial moving parts for my brain to even connect that it's a thing that I want to do. So if I can pull a physical lever and see little wheels turn, even if a computer is actually determining the answer to that and it's all just fake, that's okay. That's the level of pantomime that I need. If I'm playing a machine where it's like a video screen and I got to push a button and then I watch some animation and then tells me that I won or not, I can't do it. That said, this one, it looks neat when you're actually watching it. I have no idea how the fuck it actually is doing anything. Just shit's a bunch of different rollers of different lengths and widths all have a bunch of crazy bullshit that floats around on them, and then there's explosion noises, and then maybe you win. And I was looking at the video trying to actually like determine, like, wait, why is that? Why did they get money for that particular combination of pictures of Lenny appearing? And I don't know. So
are you done?
I don't know. Motorhead's merchandise themselves in so many weird ass ways that I don't really think they get judged by the same rules as everyone else. I mean, like,
there is a Motorhead sex toy. So I mean, after that, where can you go?
Yeah, I know.
You have just pitched a $1 million idea, Mr. John Gentile.
No, it exists.
Yeah.
You have just pitched another $1 million idea, John
Gentile. I mean, if this were like in, if I go to Punk Rock Vegas bowling next year and I see this, I would try it. But I mean, I learned from the first casino I ever went to, I just never
saw the point of these slot machines. It's just, you basically guaranteed just throwing away money. But I would try it just for the fun, I guess. I find it interesting that a slot machine needs a video trailer, though. I guess that's kind of the world we live in. But hey, I don't have as much of a problem with Motorhead licensing their name for this. I think this is just kind of something just to keep the bills getting paid, because Lemmy died. So overall, I'm kind of agnostic to this. It's fine.
I like the use of the word agnostic there. There you go.
I wonder, like, does Motorhead get a one-time fee for the slot machines, or do they get money per money brought in by the slot machine? You know, like you say, they get like $20,000 for this just to license it. It's really not worth it. It's only really worth it if, like, they get money from every slot machine, every pull, you know?
I would imagine there was probably an initial and then per. You need both, mm-hmm. man.
Yeah, yeah. We should make Adam, like, we should make Punk News slot machines.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We should make all kinds of garbage. Is it sad that when you mentioned how are they making money on this, my brain immediately went to the horrible job it would be for someone to somehow reconcile the numbers that the slot machine company told you were played in the machine with what was actually played in the machine. And suddenly I was at work, and I'm thinking about, like... like getting all this data to match. I'm like, oh God, why am I thinking about this? We're talking about Motorhead. Anyways, there's a Motorhead slot machine. You can go play it somewhere.
Right, or in you if can
send
you
find
your
money
it.
To us.
Yeah, just send your money to us.
Email it to us.
You won't win anything, but you know.
You prefer Bitcoin.
Well, what if we did what if we did sort of like some sort of like radio slot machine thing where if people send us money, then we will on the next podcast, go like, and then we'll like roll some dice or whatever we have to do. And we'll tell you if you got anything on the slot machine or not.
Wait, you basically want us to be bookies? You want to turn Punk News into a bookie organization?
No. Every time someone sends us money, we will at the start of that show, pull the virtual slot machine lever and tell them if they won anything. We'll tell you exactly what came up on the slot machine screen.
So we just pull the, so our you services will pull us. The slot machine for you, and we charge a fee for that.
And we run the slot machine, and you can't verify what we actually did.
Sounds good. I think we should start like a minimum amount they can send in to show that we're legit. Like, I think the minimum amount should be like $20.
$1,000.
I'd do it
Bitcoins.
For five, honestly.
Five.
Yeah, I'll take whatever I can get. I mean, if anyone sends us any amount of money, I will do the slot machine thing on the next episode. That's where I'm. That's my commitment to you as a consummate performer.
Where should they send it, Adam?
Oh shit! Okay. Yeah. PayPal your money to adam@punknews.org. That'd be the best way to do it. To play your slot machine.
The solicitation is real.
You're fucking right it is.
I'm pretty sure Adam White's committing federal crimes.
International crimes.
Yeah, I'm Canadian. I'm. This is like one of those international waters things.
He's bulletproof.
So, I can do whatever I want. speaking of Canada, today up here in Toronto, the mayor of Toronto, John Tory, has declared today to officially be the Tragically Hip Day, and this is to coincide with the first night of three nights of concerts that the band has in the city. The Tragically Hip right now are playing their last tour across Canada, which is basically causing the entire nation to reminisce about how basically every adult person in Canada is obsessed with this band. Mainly because singer Gord Downie has terminal brain cancer and is he has a ticking clock. He has an expiry date. We've talked about this a little bit on the show in the past, and I forget what the context was in actually talking about it. But
that he was dying. We talked about the fact that he was dying. And he had a limited amount of time left, and he was going to tour. And it's like brutal to know that you got like 3 months left, and that's it. You know.
Yeah. So this is the tour. The final date on the tour is coming up soon, which is going to be in the band's hometown of Kingston, Ontario. The tour, that actual show has become a incredibly surreal cultural moment up here in Canada in that it is to be live streamed and broadcast everywhere. Like, it is going to be on like on the CBC television, CBC radio. So like all of our like national broadcasters, there are like hockey arenas and everything in like every town that are going to be projecting it up onto whatever Jumbotron-y kind of screen they have. Like the big art center that's in St. Catharines, Ontario, near where I am, is basically like sold out the whole arena for people to come in and to watch this. It's like the whole country is going to simultaneously watch this band's last concert. It's just would. Nothing like this could happen in the States, just because there is not a single artist that the States have that everyone is like gelled around in the same way. Like even if it was like fucking Springsteen or something, it would not work. Like it just the cultural ubiquity of the Tragically Hip in Canada is amazing. So anyways, I'm not playing you a Tragically Hip song, but what I want to point you to is an article that Damian Abraham of Fucked Up recently wrote for Vice, and the article is called How I Learned It's Okay to Love the Tragically Hip and Still Be Punk. And this ties right back into what we were talking about at the start of the show, because in this article, Damian talks about being a straight edge punk rock kid in the 90s and why he hated the Tragically Hip, specifically because for the exact same reason really that I mentioned why I didn't listen to hip hop, was because you had to be against what the popular people were for. And one of the things that the popular people were for, I mean, I mentioned Tom Petty earlier in the show, man, were they into the Tragically Hip. And in the same way that I didn't listen to Tom Petty for a long time, and I didn't listen to hip hop for a long time. I definitely did not listen to the Hip for a long time, because they were the thing that everyone liked. And you're going to be, you know, anti everything, you had to be anti that. So anyways, in Damian from Fucked Up's article about this, he talks a lot about how he actually discovered the band after the fact and, became friends with Gord and this and that. And it's a good article and you should go read it. And it gives some insight into why this band matters in Canada, but also some insight into like what it was like being Adam for a weird, in a weird sense, because his experience that he describes is so close to what mine was. So what you may not know, because they didn't make a huge deal about it at the time, was that Gord from the Tragically Hip did appear on one of Fucked Up's, their most recent record, actually. There's a couple connections between him and the band. He was out, Gord was out touring with the Sadies not too long ago, and they were covering Generation? What's the fuck up song?
Generations
by Generator is the Bad Religion song. Yeah, so there's YouTube footage of it where, so Gord and the Sadies were playing Generations, which is a Fucked Up song, live, and Gord appears on the Fucked Up song The Art of Patrons, which was on Glass Boys, the newest record. He's on the song when they're singing the Mass Delusion chorus, kind of like midpoint and at the end. So anyways, I'm going to play that song because it is, it's Tragically Hip Day up here in Canada. And this is kind of a fun punk rock connection for it. John, if I'm going to play The Art of Patrons, you know what I'm going to ask you? Which one?
Oh, you know what? I mean, much ado is made about the two versions of Glass Boys. Let's go with the first record, the classic one, the non half speed master.
All right, this is the normal speed drums version, the actual version, if you will, of The Art of Patrons by Fucked Up, featuring Gord Downie of the Tragically Hip as a guest star. So here you go. We'll be back in a sec. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. That is it for the Punk News Podcast. This was a long show, but there was a lot of stuff to talk about, and we didn't even talk about all of it. We cut a whole bunch of it, so we'll be back to talk about the rest of this stuff next week. I want to thank everybody for showing up on the show. Thank you, producer Greg, for stitching this sucker together every week. If anyone wants to email us, it is podcast@punknews.org. Any parting words, John, that things people need to know?
Pick it up, ska week. Maybe next week, we'll find out.
Yeah, we could do another ska week in a week, couldn't
we? Ska week was a big hit. People really love ska week.
Yeah, it came out quite well, I thought.
Probably people liked it because it isn't the normal bullshit that we do. We should just stop doing this.
I missed out.
All right, see you guys next week.